underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Robert Thurman is a recognized worldwide authority on religion and spirituality, Asian history, world philosophy, Buddhist science, Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, and His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. His new book, Man of Peace, presents the inside story of the Dalai Lama, delving into his amazing life and vision and the high tension of the military occupation of Tibet and the ongoing genocide of its people, a work of political and historical nonfiction brought to life in the graphic novel form. Again, the name of the new book is Man of Peace, and it's a pleasure to welcome Robert Thurman to this week's book show.
Well, thank you, Joe. I'm very, very happy to be here. And first time I've come to the studio, and I enjoy being here. I think it's fun to be
very
right
nice
here.
To be face to face.
Yeah.
Before we talk about his story, I want to mine a little bit about your story and how you came to know the Dalai Lama and have the closeness and the friendship that you have now.
I dropped out of Harvard looking for better philosophy and psychology courses. And I didn't know at the time that I would want to know the Sanskrit and Tibetan languages, or I would have studied them at Harvard. But I thought India had the answers I was looking for by some affinity that I had and some reading that I had done. So I went over there as a pilgrim. Luckily, before the hippies went, I went in the very beginning of the 60s, 61, and left a marriage, actually had to leave a marriage. I wanted to take them with me, but had to leave. When I got to India, I realized it was Buddhism I wanted to know about, that they were the great philosophers, I felt. And the Indians were not able to tell me much about it, but the Tibetans were. Because the Indians lost, although Buddhism originated in India, they lost it about 1,000 years ago when they were invaded really governed by people from outside. Then eventually this led me to get to know the Dalai Lama. He made me a monk because I was so devoted to it and determined to do that. And it's a way of getting like a lifelong MacArthur Fellowship or something to be a monk. They feed you and you can study and meditate and nothing else to worry about. But that didn't last because then once I made a little progress, I realized I couldn't go too much further without developing a method of bringing others with me. And, it's not like a self-centered thing. It involves trying to be with people at the same time as developing yourself. So then I realized, as one of my older teachers had told me from the beginning, that as an American being born in this country, in this life, I had to do something in this country, and I couldn't really do it well as a Buddhist monk, Tibetan Buddhist monk. And Tibet was destroyed as far as its Buddhism went by then. And so I reverted to lay life. I went to the Western monastery, which is academia. And luckily, I met the best woman I've had a chance to meet, and she helped take care of me in the middle of all that, fell in love. And so we've had a bunch of kids, And then Dalai Lama was upset because I had been a monk at first, and he's very much did a miracle in a way of rebuilding Tibetan monastic tradition in exile as still a fairly large percentage of the Tibetan free population, like it was in Tibet, which is a very, very important aspect of Tibetan culture. So he didn't like this. He was upset that the first enthusiastic Western monk then resigned, you know. But and then I studied it, I studied a lot about it, and I realized how important the institution was. So, and then we became friends again, of course. He liked my children, actually. They shouldn't have existed, but he liked them a lot. And he liked my wife. He realized she was more enlightened than I was, so that made me more acceptable.
Robert Thurman is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new book, Man of Peace, The Illustrated Life Story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. You talk about his influence beginning when he was a man in his 20s, but you really, this surprised me in the book, you go back to the age of 15 of how he has defended the people of Tibet against the Chinese since he was a boy. Yes. And that is a really startling thing that he has been able to do that.
It is amazing. And also nonviolently. Actually, his two older brothers diverged from his nonviolent policy, which he really adopted full blast in 1951 when he was 16, after 1 year of the Chinese presence in Tibet. And he instead, they wanted him to flee immediately to India and call in the United Nations, you know, like a Korea sort of thing. And he refused, and he went back. He tried to deal with the communists and tried to, he believed Mao, that Mao would help him reform Tibet and modernize it. And he didn't realize he was going to suffer a colonial occupation and exploitation. So, but he did realize that after about 5-6 years in the late 50s. But he still vowed to do nonviolence. And Buddhist nonviolence is not simple-minded, like, please come kill me, you know, to say to your enemy. That's not really what it is. It is that soldiers are willing to die to fight to kill somebody else, and nonviolent practitioners are willing to be killed not to kill somebody else. But they do allow a preventive violence. In other words, in the Buddhist scriptures, they say if someone invades your country and you have the power to easily push them out, go ahead and then make a treaty with them and don't pursue them further. Just do enough sufficiently to defend yourself. If you don't have that power and you fight and then kill some of them, and then they will be more angry. There'll be worse bloodshed. So don't do this sort of jump off a cliff routine. That's not worth it. Then you surrender right away and then hope, try to moderate their occupation or whatever it is that they do to you. And so it's very practical nonviolence. You know, like, so, you know, you do surgery when a snake bites your hand and you cut your wrist and suck out the poison before it gets to your heart. Buddhist nonviolence has that idea. You know, it's violent cutting your arm, you know.
Right.
So he's very pragmatic, the Dalai Lama. And therefore, you know, he didn't condemn his brothers. He did in person to them, but publicly he didn't. He didn't condemn the Tibetans who fought a little in the 50s and 60s. But as he predicted, they'd lost. They wouldn't. They had no chance, really. They had no real support in the world, actually. So because everybody was sort of scared of China, like they are today. And everybody doesn't know what to do about it. They know business people want to make money in China. And security-wise, it's a huge force, and it's going to be a huge force. And so Dalai Lama is all into the peaceful integration of China, the Russians, us, the Indians. That's his dream, to work on that. So he tries to set that tone from his place on the roof of the whole situation, if you take it as a Eurasia right. situation, you know, the roof of the world. And but he's off it. He's in the foothills over in India. And he's done, I think, a great job, actually. People say, well, but Tibet is in a terrible state now and all this. And that's true. And he agrees that that's true. Chinese are really insecure about it. So they crush down on the Tibetan culture and they try to make them learn Chinese and they try to do all this and colonize Tibet. But it can't work because it's 3 miles high. They've been doing it for 50, 60 years. The Tibetans still think they're Tibetans, but they're willing to be a minority within China if respected as they are and have their Buddhism and have their environment and not be colonized by people who can't really live properly at high altitude. They would be very happy. So he's not demanding independence from China because Nehru and everybody taught him and Kissinger and Holbrooke and all of his Western friends, except me, they told him that if you ask for independence, then that means you want to fight. So you don't do that. So you stay within the Chinese thing, and that's more practical, but you just get local autonomy, which Chinese constitution actually promises their people. And there are cases in history where autonomy has worked within a federation sort of system. And that's, you know, look at New Jersey and New York. You know?
So there is that work that he has done as a leader and as a spiritual leader. But along the way, he yes. has also engaged with all people yes. who suffer, people yes. who suffer oppression, yes. people who suffer injustice.
Yes.
And you have been along for much of this ride. When did you start to see that develop, that he really became someone who spoke to the plight of those who are oppressed?
Well, as soon as he really reached his sort of full spiritual maturity, I would say, in the beginning of the 70s, kind of. In the 60s, he was still, the brothers were still doing their game. and he was still learning, and he was trying to set up things in India for the, you know, destitute refugees who came out for those 10 years. And also the Indians were keeping a lid on him because Nehru still wanted to try to make peace, do something with Mao. He thought that he and Mao would be these two new independent Asian giant nations and they would have a big say in the world. He didn't realize that Mao had no intention of letting India join in that, although Mao had his own ambitions, you know, to make the world into whatever he thought it should be. So the Dalai Lama couldn't circulate that much around the world. He was pretty constrained to be in a fairly inaccessible place in India. He then developed his insight and his sort of charismatic energy and his, and he learned deeply also, not sort of any official power sort of things, but the teaching from a very humble teacher, actually, who he found out had this sort of special tradition, oral tradition, of compassion and kindness and empathy for others, what we call the Shantideva teaching, the exchange of self and other teaching, the teaching of altruism and empathy supported by the insight into selflessness, you know, that's a Buddhist scientific teaching. And he really became a paragon of that. And he and everyone who met him beginning in those days, late 60s, early 70s, and mid 70s, became enamored of him because he was such a gentle and sweet person personally. And you can't, I've met people, I've seen big people like one I remember particularly, Fairbanks, who was a famous Chinese professor at Harvard. He met the Dalai Lama in a meeting at Galbraith's house, and he had just been to China, and he'd been brainwashed about many things, and he was also a sinologist with big sympathies for China. And so he was very paranoid about the Dalai Lama, weird Lama, what does that mean? And the minute he met, they were like the best buddies. And Galbraith was smiling, and it was sort of like rice shower. And Galbraith kind of dragged in John Fairbanks. And the minute they met, Fairbanks was like, oh. And the Dalai Lama knows a little bit of a certain dialect of Northwest Chinese because he's in Northeast Tibet, which is where he took rebirth, right on the boundary. It was like, boom, he put his boundary marker was his new body when he was 13th Dalai Lama, at least from Tibetan point of view. So he was born right next to China and he spoke as a child. So he was able to speak some Chinese. He also spent 10 months with Mao and Zhou and those people in the 50s, trying to get along with them and trying to, and he, as you said, he was brainwashed into Marxism by them, he jokingly says, you know. And especially likes to say that to serious capitalists like William Buckley and people like that.
Right.
He used to say that kind of thing.
You mentioned charisma, and it struck me. I had the great fortune of meeting the Dalai Lama, and the charisma is something that really does take you over. It is so embracing and warm and beautiful.
Yes.
How much of that is within the strain of a personality, or in his case, is it because of his religious maturity as a Dalai Lama and as a Tibetan?
Well, I think both.
Buddhist.
You know, I'm a firm believer from a scientific point of view in the multiplicity of lives, what we would call the multi-life reality
right.
view. I don't consider it a mystical thing. I consider it a scientific thing. I follow what the Tibetans feel, that he's the incarnation of a very compassionate being, automatically very empathetic and altruistic. But he also, you know, was brought up a little bit isolated, a sort of Dalai Lama, high official office and all this kind of thing. And only after exile did he sort of mix more freely with the people. And he cultivated this through this, adopting this special practice of imagine. Literally, it's like a systematic practice of putting yourself in the other person's shoes. You know, we have that expression, put yourself in the other fellow's shoes.
Sure.
And this is basically a very just a systematic way of seeing how others see things and developing a broadened awareness so that you automatically do that. In a way, mothers have that natural ability. They sort of see things from the child's perspective, so they know when they're hungry, et cetera. You know, and generally, the women of our species are better at that. Males are more push ahead into whatever they're doing. But he has specially cultivated that on top of having had a basic affinity for that. And I feel what people feel when they meet him is, for once, they feel truly heard. They feel that someone is interested in them, because he is. And in other words, it isn't like I'm over here and you're over there, kind of. They feel someone with them that they haven't felt in the same way. It's nothing magical or weird. It's just that, like, you feel when you meet someone who seems genuinely interested in you and seems immediately to like you, you kind of feel, well, you relax a little bit, you know. Right. And so it's carried to a little more intensity, but that's basically the same thing. His own people, who are predisposed very much to feel that around him, they tend to weep, actually, just a relief, a feeling of relief, or like they met their mom or something. You know, they have tears, sentimental tears, often. It's considered a good sign, actually, of someone being open-hearted.
The name of the book is Man of Peace, The Illustrated Life Story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. Robert Thurman is our guest on this week's book show. The story you tell is a very violent one. It is a very violent story.
It has been.
And yet, the title, Man of Peace, it is very much about nonviolence and about a peaceful movement. My question to you is, through your teachings, through your study, do you understand what it is? I think if you asked most people, they would say, you know, if you had to choose war and peace, you would choose peace.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, it is a difficult sell because the quick snap reaction is to get the revenge and to go after.
Right.
So my question to you is, through what you have learned and through what the Dalai Lama embodies, why is this notion of peace so hard for the world and its people to grasp?
Oh, good, very good question. You know, Shakyamuni Buddha, 2,500 years ago, was a king, a crown prince, and would have been a king. And a king in Indian society is the general of the army, you know, the commander-in-chief, just like the president of the U.S. And so he was trained for war, actually, as a warrior. But he renounced that through his own insight into what was important in life. And then he founded this world movement of enlightenment, etc., which is still very, very vital and alive today after many, many persecutions, ups and downs. But actually, the first little kingdom that went under because so many people followed him who were of his military class was his Shakya kingdom. It was beaten up by the neighboring city-state, you know, like Athens and Sparta, Indian situation was like that. And then progressively in history, those societies that have become more peaceful because of having a more inner gentleness and civilization have tended to suffer at the invasion of others who are less so. And we've seen that India was invaded, Asia as a whole was invaded because it had, if not perfectly so, but relatively more peaceful than Europe, which had a more gunpowder and compass and instruments that were important for warfare were invented by the Chinese, but they never used them to create a conquest empire. So we now, however, so therefore, the nonviolence as a sort of dogmatic thing, whatever happens, just kill me, I won't do anything, is very impractical in history, and therefore it's a hard sell. However, some people have realized today that the human genius is such, our weapons of war are so powerful, our weapons of communication and transport are so intense, and we can circle the globe in no time type of thing and drop any bomb anywhere, and then we can pollute our way also to completely ruining the agriculture of everywhere, that things are different now. And a global war, like World War II today, which would mean that somebody would want to totally escalate who was a participant. Total escalation today means the end of all the world as we know it. There's no question about it. And more slowly, the industrial pollution, climate size, also means the end of life, as we know, but that's more slow. So therefore, today, those societies that developed the skill internally to be vulnerable, to live at a higher level of being civilized and gentle and intelligent and just with each other, they went under in the past, but their legacy is now finally time to be listened to. It's like Jesus said, love your enemy, right? Then the lesson that people remember because of the Roman Empire, what they did, what Constantine and the Council of Nicaea did about Jesus' life, emphasizing his crucifixion. So therefore, we think of nonviolence as leading you to getting wasted. you know, and the resurrection is there, but it's kind of ephemeral. And in Mel Gibson's movie, Jesus, the actor, looked grumpy even after resurrecting. Himself. He still looked mad and upset. So we can't understand that very well. But now, you know, we have to love our enemy. Now, love, if you define love as wish for the happiness of a person that you love, then the enemy is only after us because they want something we have. They're against us in some way. They feel we're blocking their happiness. So if you love them, meaning want them to be happy, you're wanting them not to be your enemy. So that's a really intelligent piece of advice. Whereas it's always been written off as impractical, idealistic, and saintly, and impossible for everyone else. Now, actually, it turns out to be survival strategy for the planet is that the great war powers, they cannot continue with this nuclear things, and it's not possible. It cannot happen. Kim?
Kim Jong-un.
Yeah. We have to invite him to a pride parade on Greenwich Village or something, or in San Francisco.
I mean, Is that what we need to do?
Yeah. We need to somehow find something that will cheer him up without having to freak out that we think he's so bad, and he has been so bad. We think so. So that if he doesn't have nuclear weapons, we'll bomb him or something like that. The South Koreans need to have a chance to kind of enchant him, make some movies, do something nice with him. And we all need to do that somehow, and not give him an excuse for anger and so on. There's no way to escalate nuclear war there, you know. And China has nuclear, Israel has nuclear, Pakistan has, so every major world civilization tradition, including the Muslim one, have nuclear weapons already. So war is no longer practical as it was for the last couple thousand years. Therefore, those teachers like Buddha and Jesus and Krishna and others who taught love, not war, finally we must listen. It's not only that we have the chance to listen to them, we must listen to them.
As the final question of our conversation, let me ask you about the ending of the book, because there are great question marks in the future.
Absolutely.
And yet, I would consider, and I assume you agree, that this is a happy ending.
I think it is. The end of the book is where things are at this total dangerous place because our genius of inventing all these outer machinery without developing a similar genius of controlling our own inner psychic machinery, of our emotional machinery. So what the Indians call outer science versus inner science, we have this fantastic outer science which has magnified the imbalances in our inner world that we have not fastened our inner science on in an effective way. In fact, we've even tried to make the mind into an outer object through the dogma of materialism and think we're going to find a drug that's going to make people have a good emotion. We can do surgery on their brain or electrically stimulate it because everybody's just a brain robot, you know, a psychological robot, which is a mistaken philosophical and scientific view. He is a product of the inner science, and he is someone who exemplifies a person who can control themselves, who can rise above their negative impulses, and who can bring that to bear in a society and can have an education method where he can train thousands of other people to be like that and contribute intelligently. This is what we all need, Russians, Chinese, Americans, Indians, Persians, Arabs, Africans, Native people in the Americas. We all need this kind of education and training. We have it in our own cultures to various degrees, you know, and it can be submerged in any culture, even a so-called Buddhist culture. But the planet is forced to do that now because otherwise our greed is creating global warming and going to pollute the agricultural system, and we're all going to starve and die. If the billionaires might be a few of them living in a Quonset hut somewhere in the Arctic for a while, but they'll get so bored they won't even want to live. And our violence, our anger, is magnified by our nuclear weapons to an unusable extent. And so we have to change now.
Robert Thurman is the author of the new book, Man of Peace, The Illustrated Life Story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. He has written it along with William Myers and Michael Burbank. Robert Thurman, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you. I always learn so much in our conversations.
You,
I thank you so much.
I learn a lot from you. I love your questions, and I love you actually read the books. That's really, really brave work, hard work on your part.
Again, Robert Thurman's new book is Man of Peace. It is published by Tibet House. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.